This is Nancy Lynn Westfield, Director of the Wabash Center. I'm very pleased to add material to our Dialogue on Teaching podcast. The Wabash Center is re-releasing in podcast format the video series, The Eye That Teaches. The Eye That Teaches, produced by Associate Director Tim Lake, interviewed senior scholars to talk about their teaching lives. These scholars provide great insights into their experiences as teachers and mentors. I want to thank our sound engineer, Dr. Paul Myrie, who has worked with this technology, as well as provided original music that frames the podcast. This is Dialogue on Teaching. Dr. David Blix is on faculty at Wabash College. He is Associate Professor of Religion. Dr. Blix was a Carnegie Scholar at the Carnegie Institute for the Advancement of Teaching in Palo Alto, California. He principally teaches world religions, focusing on Islam and the religions of China and Japan, religion and culture, and methods and theories of interpreting texts. He is particularly interested in writings and things like art and architecture. We hope you enjoy this edition of The Eye That Teaches.
Welcome, Professor Blix.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Where do you teach?
I teach at Wabash College in the Department of Religion.
And how long have you been there?
I have been there approximately 25 years.
And what's your subject area?
World religions, with a focus on the one hand on Islam and the other in Chinese religions. Okay. But so, I teach whatever they tell me to teach.
Like we all do. So as a teacher, do you see it as a part of your identity?
I do. Very much. For me, teaching is always about personal interaction with students and interacting in a lively manner with people as part of my everyday life, and this is just another dimension to it. I don't look upon teaching at all as the dissemination of abstract information or simply transmitting materials. It emerges out of conversation. And I'm a conversational person, I think.
So what do you see yourself doing in the classroom?
Well, what I do is perhaps a little different from what some other people do, since I teach world religions, which, by the way, is probably not a perfect designation because I do everything but Christianity, Judaism, and Native American, which are, of course, religions around the world. But I do, for instance, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, Chinese religions, Japanese religions, etc. For most of our students, those are unfamiliar religions. So part of what I'm doing is to introduce them to things they don't know about and that lie outside of their worldview. At the same time, I'm giving them a space to rethink some of their most basic beliefs, their most basic ideas. Most college students, 18 to 22 years of age, it seems to me, even if they're coming out of a tradition, they're asking questions about it. Do I believe it anymore? Does it make any sense? And it's helpful to give them another place to stand or to sit, where they can look at another tradition, see how they approach similar questions, and that might give them some leverage in thinking about their own views. So I'm talking to them about the meaning of life, basically.
Do you have a philosophy of teaching?
A philosophy of teaching... I could go on forever about that. But yes, basically, to listen and to converse. I mean, the most important thing, if we're reading a text, listen to what the text says. Some of my colleagues like to use a word like interrogate. We interrogate a text. We interrogate an artifact. And perhaps, but I find that language sort of smacks of the KGB or the Gestapo or something like that. You have to listen first, hear what the other voices are saying, and then listen to what the students say when they say that, and then play back and forth with them and, you know, challenge them, sometimes let them challenge you. A formative moment for me in my first years of teaching was a student one afternoon just yelled at me in the seminar and said, "You're wrong." And I thought about it, and I realized he was right. I was. That's in terms of a discussion class. For a lecture class, it's theater. True, you're transmitting information, but at the same time, you act out the traditions, you do funny voices, you get the students involved, you take all questions, you challenge them. Many times students will anticipate the next step in a lecture because they see where this is going. That in a few words, I suppose, is what my philosophy is.
How do you know when teaching goes well?
Ah, that is one of the mysteries. In the actual setting, two ways of talking about that, I think. One is the immediate setting of the classroom, the discussion room or the lecture room. You look at their faces. If you see their following, if you see their eyes light up, or if you see puzzlement. I think sometimes we don't make enough room for puzzlement. We think a student should always understand, always be happy. They should be a little unhappy sometimes, a little discombobulated. If I'm seeing that occurring, then something is working. Now, I can stand by their side and encourage them and say, it's all right, your world's not going to fall apart. That's easier to do in a seminar, of course, because they're on the other side of the room. But even in a lecture, I watch faces as we're going around the room. If I see a kid looking puzzled about something, I'll call on him and say, so, you know, James, what's that look mean? There are days you don't know if it's going well. I've had days when I've come out of a class, whether discussion or lecture, and I think it was terrible. And then 2 days later, a student will come up to me and say, Dr. Blix, that was one of the best classes I've ever been in before. And so there's a complete disconnect. I have no idea what's happened. There, of course, are the standard methods of assessment, exams, papers, and that usually gives a pretty good feedback. But it's the personal stuff that matters, I think.
So is teaching mysterious?
It is. To me, it's an art.
It's an art.
Not a science. I know there's a big push these days in the academy to do studies and surveys and to collect data. And then I will be told in a discussion, such and such a study has shown. And to that my reaction is, well, no. Such and such a study does not show anything. Studies never show anything unless you mean they exhibit, but they don't show in the sense of proving or demonstrating. Studies report. Mm-hmm. They say, with these students at this time, in this place, using these questions and this instrument of research, this is what we found. Mm-hmm. I think it's in one of the AAR, somewhere in the program this time, there's a description of a somebody saying, and I can show that this works, it has proven results. Well, no, they worked for this person. So in that sense, it's not a science. You can take this stuff and use it by all means. It's advisory rather than mandatory, if you will. But beyond that, you play it by ear. Now you keep track of what you do, you make note of assignments that didn't work, days that didn't work. But I think of it more as an art.
How is your faith and your teaching related?
My personal religious faith,
yes.
You mean? For me, that's especially complex. In fact, students ask that all the time. I was raised a Presbyterian by a father who came out of a Pentecostal tradition and a mother who came out of a Lutheran tradition. That was their compromise. And I still have deep roots in that tradition. Part of that tradition is that it's the Reformed tradition. You always question your faith. You ask about it. How can I state it as clearly as possible and make sense of it? Over the years, I have come to have a kind of love affair with Roman Catholicism, to some extent Anglicanism. I teach things like Zen Buddhism, Hinduism. Inevitably, these get mingled in. And so students will say, Dr. Blix, what do you believe? And I say, well, I'm a Presbyterian with the mixture of a little Zen and Buddhism and Hinduism. And I know that's supposed to be impossible, according to some theories, but for me, that's how it plays out, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah.
So my faith is unshaken. I think it's enriched, is what I would say.
And so when you're in the classroom in that kind of positionality, how do you encounter your students?
In the classroom, the way I position myself is to do the best job I can giving a voice to the religion or the faith or the tradition that I'm teaching at the time. So if I'm teaching Islam, this semester, for instance, I have a course called Islam and the Religions of India. First half of the course is on Islam. I try to present things from a Muslim point of view. Say, this is what Muslims say. Now, there are moments when I will, I'm very careful to say, my point of view disagrees with that. For instance, the difference between biblical and Quranic views, say, of Abraham or Moses. But even then, it's always in a respectful kind of way. So I again, we're told this is not possible, but I do try to keep my personal views off to one side. But I don't try to hide them. Mm. I mean, they know I'm coming from somewhere.
Has teaching afforded you the kind of life you hope to live?
Yes, it has. Very much so. It's deeply satisfying. When a class comes alive, I'm just on a day-to-day basis, a class comes alive and the students are going at it and there's this energy flying around the room, to me that's a marvelous thing. And to watch their minds work and eyes light up and insights happen or puzzlement occurs, the anti-insight, if you will. That means I'm helping contribute to their lives. And very often, years later, a student will come up to me and say, "You may not remember this." And very often, these are like a conversation we had in the hallway. And I don't remember it. But a student will say, "You made a comment to me that was really helpful." And I found that to be a life of service, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it at every turn.
Thank you so much. This has been a wonderful conversation.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to scholars talk about their teaching life. And we're out. How was that, Paul?